Well, good morning. Right, Mr. Actually, a comment from Peter and a comment from Joy sort of give me sort of the entry to this one. Peter was talking about Iran and the earthquakes, and also Joy mentioned the situation coming in Israel, that they're dishing out gas masks and things. And I was there in the war in 2007, and they were dishing out gas masks, and we were getting our air raid shelter ready. We had this room which was going to be a sealed air raid shelter. Actually, my main concern at the time was we had a great big fluffy dog called he was a great big doggy, and she liked to sing, and I was afraid that, you know, a few hours in the air raid shelter with this dog singing would be a bit of a problem. Luckily nothing happened, but anyway, we do pray. I mean, this time something may well happen. So. Which leads into what I want to talk about. As you know, and as I've mentioned before, every village in Wales, probably in England as well, has at least two or three fellowships that never talk to each other. They never have anything to do with each other. And Abercomboy, where we used to live, it's the same. They've got at least two good fellowships and one sort of... But they don't have anything to do with each other, except that we do. Under the surface, we have a lot of dealings with one another. And there's one family in particular from a fellowship we have no dealings with, who came to have lunch with us, a couple of months ago, I think it was, John and Claire. And we had a good lunch, and then we were having a kind of biblical, godly discussion afterwards. And one of them said, why did God put his people there in the Middle East, right where he put them? And I thought, well, that's actually a good question. So I've been doing a series of Bible studies on this in Abercomboy. But so today I need to sort of crystallize it down a bit, because there are some lessons which are relevant to us here in this room. And I won't go into what I was originally going to go into. Forget the early bit about the Garden of Eden. Don't worry about that. But the first time the land is mentioned is in Genesis 12, verse 1. God called Abraham when he was in Ur of the Chaldees. Genesis 12, verse 1. Now the Lord had said to Abram, as he was in those days, get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house, to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse those who curse you. And in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. And then he made the same promise again in Genesis 15, verse 18. Genesis 15, verse 18, and he expanded it a bit. On the same day, the Lord made a covenant with Abraham, saying, to your descendants I have given this land, from the river of Egypt, which is more or less most of Sinai, to the great river, the river Euphrates. So, and he made the same promise to his Abraham's son Isaac, and then he made the same promise to Jacob, Isaac's son. And then many years later, several hundred years later, he made the promise to the Israelites when they came out of Egypt. And if you'd like to turn to Exodus 3, verse 7. Exodus 3, verse 7. And the Lord said, I have surely seen the oppression of my people who are in Egypt, and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows. So I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, and to bring them up from that land to a good and large land, to a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites, the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites. So God promised it to the people of Israel. I mean, nothing I've said so far is anything you don't know. Now, God did impose some conditions, and practically all of you are aware of two chapters in the Bible. It's Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28. These are called the blessings and the cursings chapters. God starts out by saying, if you obey my laws, I will do this. And if you don't obey my laws, I will do that. So you've got about that much of that if you obey my laws, and you've got about that much if you don't obey my laws. So let's read a little bit from Leviticus 26, verse 3. I'll only concentrate on the blessing bit, because the cursing bit would take all day. So Leviticus 26, verse 3. If you walk in my statutes and keep my commandments and perform them, then I will give you rain in its season. The land shall yield its produce, and the trees of the field shall yield their fruit. Your threshing shall last till the day of the vintage, and the vintage shall last until the time of sowing. You shall eat your bread to the full and dwell in your land safely. I will give peace in the land, and you shall lie down, and none will make you afraid. I will rid the land of evil beasts, and the sword will not go through your land. You will chase your enemies, and they shall fall by the sword before you. Five of you shall chase 100, and I'll come back to that, and 100 of you shall put 10,000 to flight. Your enemies shall fall by the sword before you, for I will look on you favorably and make you fruitful, multiply you, and confirm my covenant with you. You shall eat the old harvest and clear out the old because of the new. I will set my tabernacle among you, and my soul shall not abhor you. I will walk among you and be your God, and you shall be my people. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt that you should not be their slaves. I have broken the bands of your yoke and made you walk upright. Okay. And we carry on from there to Deuteronomy 4 verse 5. Now this really is the first point. Deuteronomy 4 verse 5. Surely I have taught you statutes and judgments, just as the Lord my God commanded me, that you should act according to them in the land which you go to possess. Therefore be careful to observe them, for this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the peoples who will hear all these statutes and say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. For what great nation is there that has God so near to it as the Lord our God is to us? For whatever reason we may call on him, and what good great nation is there that has such statutes and righteous judgments as are in all this law that I set before you this day? So God wanted his people to be an example of God's values and God's way of life. Now, is it practical to put the first map up on the wall? That's the one of the whole Middle East, basically. Okay, now this, you can see that obviously is where Israel is today. Now, God put Israel in a place where they couldn't really be anonymous, they couldn't be invisible. If you want to go down to Africa, get the ivory and the spices and everything like that in Africa, whatever they got there, you have to pass through Israel. If you want to go from Europe to, say, that way, in the Chinese direction, Indian direction, you pass near Israel. If you, practically anywhere you want to go, Israel is in the way. And if God's people, if Israel are setting, are keeping God's laws and living by God's values, then you've got travellers and people coming through there who will say, "Have you? This is an amazing people who live there. They got this amazing set of laws. They have concern and love for one another." And that was God's intention, that his people would be right there, where they weren't in a corner. Loads of people would be flowing through there all the time, and they would be an example, and God's way of life would spread throughout the globe that way. Now, there's one example in the Bible where this actually happened. 1 Kings 10 verse 1. Israel, obviously, was... They had King Saul, and then they had King David, who took practically the entire Middle East, and David's son Solomon. Now, David's son Solomon, as you know, he was the wisest man who ever existed. Now, 1 Kings 10 verse 1. When the Queen of Sheba heard about the fame of Solomon and his relationship to the Lord, she came to test Solomon with hard questions. Arriving at Jerusalem with a very great caravan, with camels carrying spices, large quantities of gold and precious stones, she came to Solomon and talked with him about all that she had on her mind. Solomon answered all her questions. Nothing was too hard for the king to explain to her. When the Queen of Sheba saw all the wisdom of Solomon and the palace he had built, the food on his table, the seating of his officials, the attending servants in their robes, his cupbearers, and the burnt offerings he made at the temple of the Lord, she was overwhelmed. She said to the king, "The report I heard in my own country about your achievements and your wisdom is true, but I did not believe these things, and I came and saw them with my own eyes. Indeed, not even half was told me. In wisdom and wealth you have far exceeded the report I heard. How happy your people must be, how happy your officials who continually stand before you and hear your wisdom. Praise be to the Lord your God, who has delighted in you and placed you on the throne of Israel. Because of the Lord's eternal love for Israel, he has made you king to maintain justice and righteousness." So, on this occasion, Israel were obeying God's laws, and the people around them were hearing about it, including, of course, the Queen of Sheba. And when I was a child, I lived in Aden, which was just with my dad. He was stationed there. And they had a system in Aden called, they had these mountains of Aden. And it used, didn't, well, every blue moon, it used to rain. All the mountain, the water would flood down the mountain into these tanks, which were called the Queen of Sheba's tanks. And she almost certainly got that technology off King Solomon, because that was part of her domain. So, would you like to put up the second map up? So what was the situation when Israel was obeying God and they had control of more or less the entire Middle East? That green is where Israel was. They had complete control. The Ammonites and the Moabites in the east, they were, and the Edomites, they were quiet. The Assyrians had basically been flattened. The Egyptians were quiet. And Israel had a deal with the Phoenicians, or people in Tyre and Sidon, up there, Tyre and Sidon, and they had world trade. I mean, there's there's abundant evidence that they actually even got as far as America. I mean, I won't go into that now, but anyway, the Phoenicians and the Israelite sailors went all over the place. And so, and also, of course, down there to India and other places. I mean, basically, Israel was in a good position under King Solomon. And they had 1.5 million men, well, under King David and also under King Solomon, they had 1.5 million men controlling this area. But then what happened at the end of Solomon's life? King Solomon decided one wife wasn't enough, so he had several hundred of them, and they were all of different religions. So he had to have temples of this, and temples for this wife, and temples for that. And basically God eventually said, that's it, you know, that, I mean, the deal is basically over, you know. You either, if you obey me, you're going to have all these blessings, and if you don't obey me, I'm going to make sure you, the blessings are taken away. So this was, that was a situation when Israel was obeying God and they controlled the land. Now, in the time of Solomon's son Rehoboam, the people came, you all know this, the people came to him and said, look, if you obey me, you will, we will serve you. But Rehoboam, being a spoiled brat, as he probably was, said, if you think my father was bad, I'm going to be 100 times worse. You know, my little finger is going to be thicker than my father's, you know. So the people said, right, that's it. We're off. And as you all know, the northern tribe split off and they became the kingdom of Israel in the north. And you had Judah and you had Benjamin in the south. And if I could have the last map. Right. Things are very different now. The situation, now the kingdom is split, the situation is totally, totally different. Starting with the southern kingdom of Judah, first of all, to the south, the Egyptians are now their enemies. Because the prime minister the king of Israel, Jeroboam, used to be Solomon's prime minister. But when Solomon wanted to kill him, Jeroboam went down to Egypt and became a personal friend of the Pharaoh of Egypt. And he became comfortable with the gods and the culture of Egypt. So, because Jeroboam of Egypt was a friend of, sorry, Jeroboam of Israel was a friend of Egypt. Egypt was now an enemy of Judah. Also, Israel was now a member of Judah. The Philistines were starting to get uppity. The Edomites, the Moabites, the Ammonites were starting to rise up. The Syrians were starting to rise up. The Assyrians. And the Babylon. So instead of having 1.5 million people facing outwards, they had those same 1.5 million soldiers facing inwards, killing one another. And that completely destroyed the unity in the Middle East. Now, yeah. Also, I've dealt with the situation of the people of the southern tribes, but the northern tribes also had a problem. Now the northern tribes, they were friendly with the Egyptians who had all their gods. So they thought, well, we'd better be polite if we sort of respected the Egyptian gods. And there's also the Phoenicians up the top. And the Israelites and the Phoenicians had this alliance, and the Phoenicians were basically Baal worshippers. So God came to Jeroboam and he says, look, if you obey my laws, I will give you the same deal that I gave to Solomon. I'll make you your dynasty eternal, like the dynasty of David. So Jeremiah thought about this, and he says, well, I've got the Egyptians to think about. I've got to keep them happy. I've got to keep the Phoenicians happy. And then, of course, I've got the Syrians up there. So I've got to do a bit of juggling here. So basically, he said, no deal. And you've seen the program, Deal or No Deal. Anyway, he said, no deal. It's one of Kerry's favourites. So this is the important point. When Israel was obeying God, God was the most real thing to them. When they fell away from God, the reality was the situation around them. So the thing is, what is our reality? Is our reality the fact that we serve the Creator God, the most powerful being in the universe? Or is our reality our noisy neighbor next door? Or whoever, you know, whatever's the big thing in our, is that our reality? Or is God our reality? Now, as you all know the history of Israel, after a series of exiles, I mean, there was the exile of the northern kingdom of Israel in 721 BC, and then, of course, the southern kingdom were exiled in 580 BC, and, of course, some of them came back, but the Romans eventually kicked them out. So for nearly 2,000 years, there was very little Jewish presence in the land. But then they started to come back. And the Arabs decided they didn't want this. And before I go on to that, I've made the same mistake I did this time as I did last week. Could you turn to 2 Kings 6, verse 8? 2 Kings 6, verse 8. You've had the same nations at war with Israel for generation after generation after generation. Then it was, in those days, it was the king of Aram, who of course is Syria. So the Syrians, in those days, were enemies of Israel. Now the king of Aram, Syria, was at war with Israel. After conferring with his officers, he said, I will set up my camp in such and such a place. The man of God sent word to the king of Israel, beware of passing that place because the Arameans are going down there. So the king of Israel checked on the place indicated by the man of God. Time and again, Elisha warned the king so that he was on his guard in such places. This enraged the king of Aram. He summoned his officers and demanded of them, tell me which one of us is on the side of the king of Israel. None of us, my lord the king, said one of his officers. But Elisha, the prophet who is in Israel, tells the king of Israel the very words you speak in your bedroom. Go and find out where he is, the king ordered, so I can send men and capture him. The report came back, he's in Dothan. Then he sent horses and chariots and a strong force there. They went by night and surrounded the city. When the servant of the man of God got up and went out early the next morning, an army with horses and chariots had surrounded the city. Oh no, my lord, what shall we do? The servant asked. Don't be afraid, the prophet answered. Those who are with us are more than those who are with them. And Elisha prayed, open his eyes, Lord, so that he may see. Then the Lord opened the servant's eyes, and he looked, and he saw the hills full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. So God had angels in those days who protected his people and of course, his prophets. And as I was saying just now, Israel was exiled from the land, and now they're back in the land. And God is still God, and his angels still exist. And I'm going to give you about three or four, these are true stories of angelic protection for the people of Israel. Now, in 1948, there was a little village called Petkiin, which was under siege by the Arabs. And they were going to wipe them out. Just as they were going to do that, they saw some strange beings with flaming swords, and they ran away. And so the village was spared. Now, in 1958, there was a man called Gershon Salomon. Have anybody heard that name? Anyway, I'll mention him later. He was up near the Syrian frontier, and he had been badly wounded. Actually, he'd been in action, and actually an Israeli tank had got too close to him, and he'd been squashed. So, and he saw the Syrian soldiers moving into the area, and they were shooting the Israeli soldiers. And they were just about to shoot him when they all threw their weapons down and ran away back to Syria. And what he saw was he saw this great white light around him. It wasn't sort of individual, it was a kind of white light which surrounded him. And the Syrians said that what they saw was sort of white angels, and they were chasing them, so they basically scarpered and they dropped their weapons and went back to Syria. And this man, Gershon, he is now in charge of the temple restoration. He's got all the bits and pieces, so when the temple is rebuilt, it's all gone, everything there is going to the temple. So temple faithful, they're called. Now, so that's just. Now, in 1967, there's a man called David Yaniv. He was a young Israeli. I suppose he's about 19 at the time. He's an Israeli. I suppose he's the equivalent of a second lieutenant. He had a patrol of nine. He was a parachute regiment. Patrol of nine other men, and they had to skirt around Jerusalem trying to find a way where the Israeli tanks could come in to attack Jerusalem. However, they were spotted by the Jordanians, and several hundred Jordanians attacked them. And so they dug in, and they agreed, there's no point being taken alive, so we'll just die expensive. Have you ever heard Michael Caine's testimony? He was in the Korean War, and they were on a patrol in no man's land, and the Chinese spotted them, and they were going to kill them. So the officer said, "We're going to die, so let's die expensive," and that was the way he put it. So he and his men charged, but they charged in the wrong direction, and they managed to escape the Chinese. You know, the Chinese were behind them, so they charged into the Chinese trenches, and they managed to escape somehow. So we've got Michael, you know, as I say, not a lot of people know that. So anyway, these Jordanians were charging the 10 Israeli parachutists, and then they're about 25 yards away, and they all started yelling, "Ibrahim, Ibrahim!" And they dropped their weapons and put their hands in the air and surrendered. So these sort of very astonished parachutists, they sort of rounded them up, took them back for questioning. And they said, "Well, why did you run away from 10 Israelis?" And he says, "Well, Abraham got up in front of us and told us to surrender. So we did." So now this David Yaniv, he shortly after that, he accepted Jesus as his personal saviour. So he had to leave the country, and he, for a long time, he ran a messianic fellowship in Canada. I think he's dead now, actually, I believe. But that's another. And now, in the 1973 war, there was he obviously was fighting in the north, and then was fighting in Sinai. Now, there's one lone Israeli, and he comes across a column of Egyptian soldiers. And as he's an Israeli, and they're the country that they invented the word chutzpah, he marches up to the Egyptian commander and says, "Surrender." And the Egyptian commander and all his men surrender to this one Israeli. So he marched them all back to the Israeli lines, and he's told the commander, "Well, you know, don't take this personally, but why would you want to surrender to one Israeli?" And he said, "What are you talking about? There are thousands of you." And he said, "What do you mean? I was on my own." He said, "There are thousands of you. But I did notice that as we were coming towards the Israeli lines, your soldiers started disappearing one at a time. Until we got to the Israeli lines, it was just you." So that's a true story. Another story I heard, a friend of mine used to be a member of the church, a fellow called Martin Seif, I don't know if you met him, anyway, Jewish guy. He was on the Mount of Olives once, and he was attacked by stone-throwing kids. They were throwing. And he was rescued at the nick of time by an Israeli soldier, great bluff Israeli. So he told the kids to clear off. And then Marty, he turned around to thank them, to thank this man, and he vanished. So, and something like that happened to me once, and I'm convinced on reflection it was an angel. Now, even younger than I am now, I did a cycle trip across Europe on a tandem, and we were just about to leave England. We were walking up a hill because, you know, it was dark and our tandem wasn't very good at hills. And this guy suddenly appears and he stopped chatting and he said, "Where'd you get your tandem?" So I said, "Oh, I told him where we got it." And we're going. Anyway, he said, anyway, he walked off and said, "Goodbye to us in Hebrew, Laila Tov." And he sort of turned around to say goodbye and he'd gone. So I don't know if that was an angel or not, but I think it was, thinking about it. But the point is this. God is very real. He has real power. He has real angels that really do help. And it's not just the people in Israel. We are also God's people, doing God's will. And God puts us where he wants us to be. And we can either, our reality can either be the problems we've got around us, or can be the fact that we serve the living God who has all the power that we need for our protection. And I'll leave that with you.